This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. Colorado recently started issuing gender-neutral driver's licenses. For some, it's been a long time coming. But there are still a few hurdles to overcome. We'll hear about how the state is trying to make it easier to make the switch.
Then, Western Water managers met in Las Vegas last week, not to gamble, but to figure out how to deal with a dwindling Colorado River.
It reminds me of the seven stages of grief, because I think we've been in denial for a long time.
We look at why it's taken so long to hammer out new deals to manage the river's declining reservoirs. Plus, we get to hear how train sets became such a holiday staple, and we'll hear a review of Cold War from film critic Howie Mofsovitz.
But before we get to all of that, last week I pulled some people into the studio to hear about their favorite holiday movies, and this week we have a few more people to hear from.
Hi, my name's Lee Patterson, and I'm a reporter with Guns in America at KUNC. My favorite holiday movie is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation because the dorky, adorable main character, Clark Griswold, reminds me a lot of my own father.
Hi, I'm Michael Dioana, and I'm an investigative reporter with KUNC. My favorite holiday movie is A Christmas Carol.
This is Ryan Thompson. I'm the operations manager at KUNC. Every year on Christmas Eve in my house, my husband and I watch Gremlins. It's kind of our tradition. I like it because it understands that not everyone loves the holidays. It also has a Christmas tree full of demons that attacks the family. So it's great. Recommended.
So whatever traditions get you through this holiday season, whether it's cheer or Gremlins, happy holidays. Okay. Enough of this sappiness for now. Let's catch up with what's been going on in our Colorado backyard. What do we have this week, Erin?
Well, Carly, it's shaping up to be a pivotal time for Colorado's LGBT community. The Colorado Board of Health approved new rules this week to make it easier to change one's gender on a birth certificate, removing costly medical and legal hurdles from the process. Attorney Emma Shin was part of a court case that prompted the vote.
It's a really big deal for trans folk because now they're going to have a document from the state validating who they are without having to jump through unnecessary, expensive, and, truth be told, risky hoops.
The changes follow other efforts by the state allowing transgender residents to update their status on other forms of personal ID, like a driver's license. But as KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, there are still a few obstacles yet to overcome.
You'd be one of the very few that gets actually see this.
Jade Koch doesn't like showing people her Colorado driver's license. Sitting on the couch in her living room in Fort Collins, she points to the little F under sex. She says it doesn't fit her.
I personally fall into non-binary agender, like no gender.
Koch uses they, them, and she, her pronouns instead of male or female. Koch says it may not seem like a big deal, but having the wrong gender marker on her license has been a huge burden.
I've been shot at. I've been jumped. I have been physically assaulted on more than one occasion. So, like, that one little marker genuinely makes all the difference and prevents a lot of that.
To accommodate, the state recently started offering a third gender-neutral X option on driver's licenses. It's only the fifth state to do so.
So the rules are actually fairly simple.
Mike Hartman is executive director of the Colorado Department of Revenue, which oversees the Department of Motor Vehicles. He says anyone wanting to change gender on their license can now print a special form from the DMV's website.
And works with their licensed mental health or medical provider to identify what exactly mark they should have on their driver's license, whether it's M, F, or X.
Gender changes also no longer require proof of sexual reassignment surgery, a qualifier that was approved by the state back in 1984. That requirement was challenged in a Denver district court earlier this year.
We know that this is one of the main barriers that exists for transgender people.
Daniel Ramos is with the advocacy group One Colorado. It's one of several LGBT organizations that pushed for the new rules.
This is just another way that we continue to send a message that all are welcome in Colorado, that we value people, and that we want to make sure that we're eliminating many of these costly barriers to ensure that transgender and non-binary people can get identity documents that match who they are.
The state has already issued more than two dozen gender-neutral IDs since November 30th, and there's been no major effort to stop it. But for some, like Jade Koch, finding the right doctor to sign off for them has been difficult.
Yeah, this was one of the first ones I bought from the little record shop down in Loveland.
Back in her living room, Coke is showing me her vinyl collection. She says she's called around to doctor's offices, but they're either booked up or not familiar with the DMV's new form.
It's been a nightmare. I've had doctors flat out say, nope, will not. Find someone else.
She hopes to get her ID changed soon, but says it would be easier without having to get a doctor's signature.
We just need to stop the gatekeeping with, oh, you need to go see a medical professional and have this form. If we can just do away with that and just believe trans people, that would be lovely.
And Coke may get her wish. LGBT advocacy groups are working with the state to adopt yet another set of rules that allow people to self-affirm, meaning they wouldn't need a doctor's signature. Hearings on those are set for early next year. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
Water managers throughout the West were supposed to finish drought contingency plans for the Colorado River by the end of the year, but they are likely to miss that deadline. KUNC's Luke Runyon looked into it. Let's see what he found out.
On stage in a gilded conference room at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, Keith Moses says coming to terms with the limits of the Colorado River is like losing a loved one.
It reminds me of the seven stages of grief. Because I think we've been in denial for a long time.
Moses is vice chairman of the Colorado River Indian Tribes, a group of four tribes near Parker, Arizona. The denial eventually turned to pain and then guilt as it became clear just how big the gaps were in supply and demand on the river. And for the last 6 months, water leaders in Arizona have been experiencing the third stage of grief, anger and bargaining.
Even though we reach situations where maybe we're about to all break out in a brawl in there, we come back to the table.
Moses is referring to a series of public meetings to hash out the details of drought contingency plans. Arizona has had a hard time agreeing on how to rein in water use and avoid seeing the river's largest reservoirs, Lakes Mead and Powell, drop to extremely low levels. Catherine Sorensen is director of Phoenix's water utility. She characterized the process this way.
Interesting, complicated, might one say difficult.
If arid conditions continue to plague the watershed, like they have for the last 19 years, Sorensen says the state stands to lose a big portion of its Colorado River water. Just who takes those cuts and when is what needs to be figured out.
That's a painful conversation. And of course, everyone thinks that their own water use is justified and that no one else's is.
Hopefully you get some boots on or something.
One of the loudest voices in the debate comes from a small group of farmers in rural Pinal County, Arizona, south of Phoenix. They could see their supplies zeroed out within 2 years under current rules. Brian Rhodes doesn't want that to happen. He's the county's biggest grower. We're standing next to one of his alfalfa fields. It's being flooded by water carried in a concrete canal.
We're going to have to take large cuts. We all understand that.
Pinal farmers like Rhodes have been criticized for being the squeakiest wheel in getting the drought plans finished. He says that's unjustified.
The reason why Pinal County is fighting so hard on this is because it is so important. You know, we're just trying to survive.
The grieving, or drought planning, is much further along elsewhere. States in the river's upper basin, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Wyoming, have finished their deal. Amy Haas is the director of the Upper Colorado River Commission.
We need to act now. We're losing time.
Climate change is already stressing the Colorado River, reducing its flow and sapping its reservoirs that supply water for 40 million people. And projections from the federal government show it only getting worse.
We've got to be prepared to deal with changing conditions. And how do we adapt to those? I mean, I think that we didn't anticipate, certainly, what we're seeing today.
Water managers thought they had solved the problem 11 years ago with an agreement that was supposed to manage water shortages. John Weisheit was there when it was signed.
Everybody was quite excited, and I wasn't. I was kind of frowning.
Weisheit is with Living Rivers, a conservation group, and lives in Moab, Utah. He felt the much-touted plan didn't go far enough and would result in plummeting reservoirs.
So I'm still really concerned that there's going to be system failure in the Colorado River Basin.
Preventing that failure is the job of Brenda Berman, current commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. At the Vegas conference, she told water managers to skip ahead a few steps in the grieving process and get to acceptance.
Close isn't done. Only done will protect this basin. Today's level of risk is unacceptable, and the chance for crisis is far too high.
Berman set January 31st as the deadline to complete the plans. Without signed agreements, she says the federal government is prepared to step in and make the decision for them. I'm Luke Runyon in Las Vegas.
Aaron, I seriously cannot believe Christmas has snuck up on us this fast.
I know. Where did the time go?
I don't know. It feels like yesterday that I was complaining about how hot it was outside and I had a Halloween countdown.
Yeah, no, it literally was yesterday. You said it was hot outside, even though it was in the 40s. And yes, you said there are less than 320 days to Halloween.
I did restart my countdown. I mean, I wish it would snow more. It's the time of year where it feels like the holidays to me when it snows.
Yes, absolutely.
What is the one thing that makes you feel like it's the holiday season?
Eggnog. I know not everyone loves eggnog or can even put up with it. For me, it is just not the holidays until I get some eggnog.
Eggnog. I don't know. I haven't tried it. Maybe I'll have to try it this year.
Yeah. If you like thick, milky.
Maybe not. Maybe not. How about we hear from...
I really sold it, didn't I?
How about we hear from other people around the office? I drag them into the studios again just to hear what their favorite part about the holiday season is.
Hi, I'm Margot. I do the midday show on KUNC sister station 105.5, the Colorado Sound. It's not Christmas at my house until Thanksgiving evening, when the traditional airing of Nat King Cole's The Christmas Song plays. My dad would always grumble about it, but it made my mom so happy that even though I haven't lived at home for almost 30 years, I can't have Christmas without it.
Hi, I'm Kyra Buckley, Morning Edition host and reporter at KUNC. Growing up, my parents owned a breakfast restaurant, and the only days it would close was Thanksgiving and Christmas. And on those days, my mom, dad, and I would go down to the restaurant to make our own meals. It was a great way to spend time together, and I felt like the luckiest kid in the whole world that I got to have breakfast in a restaurant on Christmas Day.
Hi, my name is Catherine Welch. I'm the news director here at KUNC. My favorite holiday food is cookies because, well, cookies.
Hi, I'm Mark Applegate, host of the 9 o'clock blues Sunday nights on KUNC's sister station, the Colorado Sound. My favorite holiday memories are all tied to those years when I was playing in bands. People would always be so happy on holiday nights. The feedback was always a treat. And no doubt it's no surprise that New Year's Eve shows were the most fun. Music makes for happy holidays. Hope you have happy holidays.
I cannot believe we're getting so close to the new year. 2019 is almost upon us, and we want to hear from you, our listeners. If you ever wondered how Blucifer got his name,
or if you want our reporters to dive deeper into water stories, or, you know, maybe what's happening at the state capitol, let us know. Go to KUNC.org/curious and submit your questions.
Stay with us. We've got a review from our film critic, Howie Mofsovitz, to get to and so much more.
But before we start chugging along too fast, from the Polar Express to the traditional model set around the tree, trains and Christmas go together, kind of like Santa and cookies.
Yeah.
KUNC Stacey Nick takes us to a place in Greeley where folks have a one-track mind, especially at this time of year.
Tell Santa what you want for Christmas.
No matter where he's at this time of year, Santa Claus gets all kinds of toy requests.
A little bit of everything, from dump trucks to Barbie dolls to ninjas in the PJ Masks and trains.
And while Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles have only been around for a few decades, trains have topped the wish list for a long, long time. They're an almost inextricable part of the holiday season.
Christmas is when all of America are model railroaders. They just don't know they are.
Touted as the largest in the country, the museum, located just off of a set of real railroad tracks, features more than 80 scale miles of track and 5,500 square feet of scenery, including a new Department 56 collection donated earlier this year.
Trains and Christmas, we put them under our trees. We see them when we go to the malls. We go and we look at train layouts and store windows. It's a joy for us.
The Christmas in the City scene currently on display is only 1% of the donation, which includes every piece ever made in the Heritage Christmas Village collection since 1984.
There's Radio City Music Hall with the Rockettes right in front of it.
Also nearby is the Coca-Cola sign with Santa and the ball at the top of One Times Square waiting to drop on New Year's Eve. On the other end are ice skaters around a pond in Central Park. And running through it all is a Santa's Polar Express model train. The dazzling display caught the eye of 3-year-old Jonathan Guybe and his mother, Nikki.
Do you like trains?
Yes.
What do you like about trains?
We don't move them.
You like to move them, huh?
Yeah.
Back to the train.
You can tell it's not their first time at the museum.
They love trains.
Do they have trains at home?
Yes. Yes.
You said that with a very deep sigh.
There are so many trains, and when you step on trains, they hurt.
In another part of the museum, George Brownlee is getting an early introduction to trains.
George is 15 months.
Mom Stephanie and Dad Ken brought him to see Santa and to check out the trains. It's their first time at the museum, but Ken hopes it sparks the same love for model trains in his son that he had growing up.
Absolutely. I still have my old set, and can't wait to give it to him and help him set it up again.
But when it comes to trains, that sense of wonder never seems to go away, no matter how old we get.
Yes, sir, and we are at 2650 feet. We're ready to go west anytime you need one.
Okay, 221, go ahead and pull.
I started being interested in trains when I was about 3 years old. I mean, back in when I grew up in the early 1950s, that was a pretty much normal thing for a father to take the kid down and watch trains.
Today, museum volunteer Bill Botkin is working as a dispatcher. He says watching trains led to an interest in collecting model trains and later to photographing steam engines, which he's done for more than 40 years. He's been with the organization since 2008, driving up often weekly from his home in Centennial. But among the volunteers, his commute isn't even the longest. That claim to fame belongs to Steve Watrous.
Johnston, Iowa. It's a suburb of Des Moines.
The retired 68-year-old makes the 1,300-mile round trip every other month. For Watrous, trains are about nostalgia. His mother's family worked for the Union Pacific Railroad out of North Platte, Nebraska, and he says he remembers riding on the mail trains and watching the steam engines.
And when you're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old and watch those big black monsters go by puffing smoke and steam and shaking the ground, I'm a guy. I was hooked.
As for the rest of the world's more seasonal affection for trains.
How do I explain it? You want to go clear back when everybody traveled by train. Before the airplanes, it was the most popular way to get to go see relatives and Christmas. And there's just something about snow, winter, gathering. It's all about Christmas. For me, it's year-round.
So it's always Christmas.
Yes.
Stacy Nick, KUNC.
The new film from Poland, Cold War, has won major honors all over the U.S. and Europe. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who also teaches film and television at CU Denver, the film not only shows Polish history, but has a lesson for today's world, too.
Polish-born filmmaker Paweł Pawlikowski was born in Warsaw in 1967. When he was 14, his mother took him to London and to exile from Poland. He studied at Oxford, became a filmmaker in England, and in 2013 moved back to Poland to make the Oscar-winning Ida, about a young Polish girl in the early 1960s who's about to become a nun when she learns that she was born Jewish and her parents had been murdered during the war. There's a hint of autobiography in Ida because Pawlikowski himself learned in his teens that his grandmother was Jewish and had been murdered at Auschwitz by the Nazis. Pawlikowski now lives in Paris, and his new film, Cold War, also has some autobiography lurking in the background. The movie's about the conflict of being an exile, caught between the Soviet bloc and the West from 1949 into the late 1960s, when the West offered freedom, art, jazz clubs, bars, and restaurants, but Poland offered home. Cold War opens in 1949 with collectors recording traditional songs in rural Poland. A young woman joins a troupe of singers whose government-directed task is to sing those songs in honor of the heroic Polish workers. Zula, Joanna Kulig, is good at it. She's pretty and lively. And soon she falls in love with Victor, Tomasz Kot, one of the group leaders. But soon after that, she stands him up for a rendezvous in East Berlin. They've planned to escape together, but Victor's left to go it alone. What follows are jumps in time, border crossings, and passionate meetings. They both have other lovers. Zula marries at one point, but their deep-seated love is for each other. Pawlikowski films Cold War in the old 3-to-4 aspect ratio and in black and white. He's not looking for old-timiness or nostalgia. Pawlikowski wants to show the world in the palette in which it was filmed and seen at the time. But the black and white also opens up nuance in ways that color cannot. Color divides objects decisively, but with black and white, everything's on a scale, so distinctions between objects and people are less crystalline, and visually, everything's somehow connected. It's beautiful in a Cold War kind of way, in spite of dreary weather, bleak streets, rubble left over from World War II, and what seems to be constant winter. Vehicles and people struggle through the weather and the mud. And the tough conditions make it less surprising when the ideology of the state is shoved into the performances. It starts with the heroism and greatness of the poor and the workers. Then one of the young leaders of that music group back in 1949 shows himself to be a good Stalinist, as he coldly suggests they follow the directive to make land reform and peace into central themes. And then, naturally, the choir must finally add lyrics about wonderful Stalin. Neither Victor nor Yula make good communists, though. They're too passionate and too thoroughly in love. Exile is their struggle, and Cold War makes it hurt. Victor goes to cafes in Berlin and Paris. When Zula joins him, she sings and he plays jazz. They live in a garret, but it's not romantic. They become homeless, meaning they have no place in the world. As Kaczmarek, the old toady from Poland, tells Victor, he's adrift in the West, and he's no longer a Pole. He hasn't lived Polish life in a long time. Krzysztof Zanussi, now 80 years old and still one of Poland's great filmmakers, says that because the nation of Poland has been so often overrun, it's the duty of Polish artists to come to grips with Polish history. Cold War does just that for Poland and for the rest of the world now grappling with refugees. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofsiewicz.
All right, one last thing before we get out of here.
Every year, kids across the globe follow Santa Claus on his Christmas Eve journey from the North Pole. The trackers, they're with the military in Colorado Springs at NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. KUNC's Michael DeJuana has been tracking the Santa trackers, and he spoke with Kyra Buckley about how it got its start.
For those who don't know, this is part of a long-standing holiday tradition by the military, right?
Oh, yeah. This is their 63rd year of tracking Father Christmas.
NORAD tracks and detects aerial threats, which is serious stuff. So how does Santa fit into this?
Well, first I want to say Santa is not considered a threat.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying.
A second, tracking goes back to the 1950s when NORAD was called the Continental Air Defense Command. At the time, Air Force Colonel Harry Schaup was in charge. And if something went wrong, he had a hotline so that he could let commanders know if they needed to scramble the jets or ultimately inform the president. He passed away in 2009, but our partners at StoryCorps caught up with his children, and his kids said the hotline rang one day in December of 1955.
He answered it. This is Colonel Schaup. And then there was a small voice that just asked, is this Santa Claus?
Dad was very straight-laced, very disciplined.
He was annoyed.
He was upset.
He thought it was a joke.
Yeah, and so now the little voice is crying.
And Dad realized that it wasn't a joke. So he talked to him, ho-ho-hoed, and asked if he had been a good boy, and may I talk to your mother?
That's Terry Van Curen, Richard Schaup, and Pamela Farrell in 2014. It turns out that Schaup's hotline number was misprinted in a newspaper ad by a department store with a Santa wish line.
So the hotline pretty much ended up being compromised.
It was. But the colonel, he kind of rolled with it. He assigned some staffers to answer calls from kids.
It got to be a big joke at the command center. You know, the old man's really flipped his lid this time. We're answering Santa calls.
All right, but why not just change the number?
Right, it could have ended there. But in the command center, there was a big board that tracked planes, and on Christmas Eve, someone drew a picture of Santa on a sleigh being pulled by flying reindeer. When the colonel saw it, he was like, "What's that?" There were immediate apologies, offers to take it down, but Schaup, he just stood there and looked at it for a while. Then he got on the phone.
Next thing you know, Dad had called the radio station and had said, "This is the commander at the Combat Alert Center, and we have an unidentified flying object. Why, it looks like a sleigh."
And the media loved it. Reporters kept calling every hour to see where Santa was on his journey.
And that's how a Christmas tradition was born?
Yeah, and NORAD's had a lot of fun with it over the years. Here's some vintage tape. Andrew Lawrence, a first lieutenant with NORAD, giving a radio update in the 1980s.
"Well, I'm sad to report there's still no activity from the North Pole, and I can see genuine concern on the faces of all the trackers and flight analysts here at NORAD Command. Santa has never been this late before. Of course, we logged late departures of Santa Claus in 1964 and again in 1971, but he's never been this far off schedule. Many here are saying that Santa may not come this year because not enough little boys and girls were good."
NORAD eventually reported that Santa made his journey that night, so not to worry.
Given today's media landscape, I'm thinking smartphones, smartwatches, and other ways that people track things in real time, do kids still call the hotline?
Yes. NORAD received 126,000 calls from around the world last year, and they're bracing for the same this year. But there's also updates on the NORADSanta.org website in several different languages. That had 18 million visits last December. And I spoke to Air Force Major Mark Lazane, and he explained how NORAD's radars and satellites hone in on a certain famous reindeer.
"Rudolph's nose produces a great amount of heat, and we're able to track that infrared signature, similar to if a missile was to be launched anywhere on the Earth, NORAD would be able to track that. So that same heat signature idea is how we were able to track Santa."
Wow, Michael, I'm just imagining Harry Schaup, the colonel that started all of this, just having a twinkle in his eye.
I have seen photographic evidence of that with a wink and a nod, just like Saint Nick. And this whole crazy business of tracking Santa turned out to be a defining moment in the colonel's life. I'll leave you with these last thoughts from his kids.
"Later in life, he got letters from all over the world, people saying, 'Thank you, Colonel, for having, you know, this sense of humor.' And in his 90s, he would carry those letters around with him in a briefcase that had a lock on it, like it was top secret information. You know, he was an important guy, but this is the thing he's known for.
It was probably the thing he was proudest of.
Oh, I'm sure it was, yeah."
Michael, thanks so much for bringing us this story.
My pleasure.
If you want to learn more about the Colonel, tracking Santa, and the number to call NORAD, go to our website, kunc.org.
Whether you celebrate the holiday or not, I think we can say from all of us here at KUNC, happy holidays.
We wish you a safe, joyous, and stress-free holiday.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members.
If you enjoy listening and you're not yet a member, don't let 2018 end without making a contribution at kunc.org. We can't do any of this without you, so thank you.
Thank you.
Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at kunc.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.